Protecting livelihoods from the impact of disasters must move up the policy agenda.
Asia prepares for future natural disasters. It's Monday, October 16th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're on Facebook, too, at VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, Australia moves to protect indigenous language and probe a hacking mystery. China has a new richest man. Aid agencies up their push in Bangladesh. Less money means more pain. An old bird takes flight. It's all on today's VOA Asia. One of the leading factors in the number of disasters around the world this year has come via the weather. VOA Asia's Ira Melman is here on the efforts of a United Nations agency to deal with the changing natural events.
The scope of the problem worldwide was drawn up during a meeting last week in Bangkok by Shamshad Akhtar, the executive secretary of ESCAP, the UN's Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific.
2017 has been another year where once again we have witnessed tragic disasters. Typhoon Hato cut across Hong Kong and Macau and then stretched all the way to Vietnam. Torrential monsoon rains descended on Bangladesh, India, and Nepal. Too many lives have been lost again. The devastating scale of the damage and its impact on livelihoods and the global economy cannot be understated.
Akhtar said that the people most affected by these disasters are located in the Asia and Pacific region.
The poorest and most vulnerable people are disproportionately affected by these losses. The region accounts for over half of the world's absolute poor. They are the most vulnerable, and disasters can destroy their meager assets and income. The poorest populations cannot use savings or assets to cope with unforeseen adversity. After a disaster, the poorer households face a range of challenges linked to reduced food availability, children being forced to no longer attend school, and the forced sale of assets occurs to meet the immediate needs. These disproportionate impacts widen socioeconomic disparities, exasperate existing inequalities, and trap people in poverty from one generation to the next.
Then warned the agency's executive secretary, there is the effect of climate change, which has and continues to cause great economic damage to the region's country's SDG, or Sustainable Development Goals.
Climate risk scenarios also warn of considerable future uncertainties due to an alarming geographical shift in drought risk in South Asia and Southeast Asia, as well as an increase in the intensity of tropical cyclones in the Pacific. The flood risk in transboundary river basins of the region is likely to increase 2 to 6 times under moderate and severe climate scenarios.
That, says Akhtar, calls for action.
Protecting livelihoods from the impact of disasters must move up the policy agenda. There has to be a recognition that even the most efficient early warning systems may not alone be enough.
Akhtar's description of the ESCAP report led the countries in attendance at the meeting to establish a group to be called the Asia-Pacific Disaster Resilience Network, aimed at regional cooperation. The committee said it would follow the blueprint of a similar plan that had contributed to multi-hazard early warning systems in Indian Ocean Rim countries. Ira Melman, VOA Asia.
These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. Hong Kong, southern China, brace for typhoon. Protesters march in Australia to allow asylum seekers in. Australian state enacts landmark laws to revive Aboriginal languages. Bomb kills Pakistani troops seeking captors of freed Western family. Afghan police stop truck filled with explosives, foil Kabul attack. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. A drive is on in Australia to restore the identity and culture of the country's native non-European peoples. New South Wales has become the first state in Australia to bring in laws to recognize and revive Indigenous languages. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports dozens of languages and dialects are thought to have been lost since European colonization in the late 18th century.
There were once deliberate attempts by Australian authorities to eradicate Indigenous languages that were considered to be inferior to English. About 250 First Nation languages existed when British settlers arrived in the late 18th century, but only around half are thought to exist today. Campaigners say that reviving them is not about nostalgia, but restoring cultural pride and identity. The New South Wales Aboriginal Affairs Minister Sarah Mitchell said new legislation would help them to be reawakened and nurtured. The laws will ask a panel of First Nation linguists to help guide official policy, and a new centre of excellence will also be set up. Ray Kelly, an Indigenous academic at Australia's University of Newcastle, says it's a momentous time.
This is a magnificent day. Its genesis is 30 years, 40 years old. So people have been talking about the rights for language and the protection of Aboriginal languages for so long.
But Indigenous elders have also cautioned politicians not to exert too much control over the preservation of ancient languages. Murray Butcher said it was important that power lies with Aboriginal communities, not Parliament.
Let's do something right and help us save our languages. Put the power back into our people to save our languages and let us control our own destiny.
Aboriginal languages date back thousands of years and are not simply about communication. They are repositories of ancient beliefs and customs and a vital part of the living history of Indigenous Australians. First Nations people or Native Australians make up about just over 3% of Australia's national population. They suffer disproportionately high rates of ill health, early death, unemployment and imprisonment. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Phil Mercer has also been looking into the case of a mystery hacker who was given the alias of a TV soap opera character who has stolen sensitive information about Australia's multi-billion dollar warplane and Navy projects. Intelligence officials say the break was significant, although the Australian government insists that only low-level data was taken. The identity of the cybercriminal is not known.
The virtual break-in saw cyber thieves take illustrations of a major Australian naval project. About 30 gigabytes of data was stolen. Details about new fighter planes, submarines and Australia's largest warships were also compromised. The breach began in July last year, but the Australian Signals Directorate, a domestic spy agency, wasn't alerted until November. Intelligence officials say the hack, which targeted a private defence contractor in South Australia's state, was, in their words, extensive and extreme. But the government is insisting there was no threat to national security. Australia's Defence Industry Minister Christopher Pyne says only low-level data was taken.
I'm pleased in a way that it reminds Australian business of the dangers that lurk out there. The information that's been stolen is commercial information. It's not classified information, so it's not military information. The government's doing its job. Australian businesses need to be thorough in providing for their cyber security, otherwise they won't get contracts with the government.
It's thought the hacker had exploited a weakness in software being used by the government contractor in the city of Adelaide, which hadn't been updated for 12 months. Australian cybersecurity officials humorously dubbed the mystery attacker Alf, after a character on the popular TV soap opera Home and Away. They haven't said if they suspect a foreign state was involved. Earlier this year, Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull said cybersecurity was the new frontier of warfare and espionage, while announcing new measures to protect Australian governments and businesses from foreign interference. Last year, a foreign power reported in sections of the Australian media to be China installed malicious software on computers at Australia's National Weather Bureau. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, Myanmar army officials say they have opened an internal probe into the behavior of Burmese troops in Rakhine State, where Myanmar military forces are accused of committing widespread atrocities against members of the Muslim Rohingya minority. It is not immediately clear when the military will release its findings. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thank you for listening. There is a new richest man in China. And it's not real estate magnate Wang Jialan of the Dalian Wanda Group. It's 39-year-old real estate developer Xu Jian, chairman of China Evergrande Group, worth an estimated $43 billion. The Hurun Report, which was formed in 1999, is now out with its 2017 list of the country's rich and famous. Luxembourg-born Rupert Hugwerf is chairman of the chief researcher of the Hurun Report. Speaking to VOA's Victor Beatty from Shanghai, Hugwerf said for the 12th time in 19 years, there is a new number one richest person in China, which underscores the dynamic nature of wealth in the world's second largest economy. He said Xu's rise has been meteoric.
He's probably one of the fastest growers ever in China. In terms of his wealth went up $30 billion pretty much in the last 6 months. And that's on the back of more than doubling his sales in real estate.
Rupert, he's chairman of a group called China Evergrande Group. What's that all about?
China Evergrande is a real estate developer. It's building houses. They've been one of the fastest growing real estate developments in China. What's interesting is that they this year, for the second time, broke into the Global 500 in terms of their sales, which I think is hitting above $50 billion. So that's a lot of houses that they've been selling. The boss, Xu Jian, he's got about 70% of the listed company.
Rupert, you say that it's been a good year in China for manufacturing, cars, education, TMT, and healthcare. What do you mean?
On this year's Hurun China Rich List, we've got 2,000 people. The main source of wealth has been manufacturing for about one-third, followed by real estate, followed by IT, finance, investments, and healthcare. The big trend is that manufacturing for the last 5 years has been going up. So there are more people doing manufacturing. Real estate has been going down. There are less people doing real estate. And I suppose in real estate, what's happened is that it's become more centralized. It's become less fragmented as an industry. Manufacturing, well, China's very much been a sort of the manufacturing capital of the world. And they're now sort of trying to develop from traditional manufacturing to advanced manufacturing, and we're seeing some really fascinating changes there. There's a lot of new businesses developing. For example, in healthcare, there's a company called Wuxi Pharma. That is a company that's just gone public in the last year. They have 8,000 employees who have got doctorates and above, which is pretty amazing. Of the 22 drugs approved last year by the FDA, 16 of them were researched by this company called Wuxi Pharma.
Rupert, what about some of the familiar faces, people like Alibaba Group Holdings' Jack Ma and property magnate Wang Jianlin? Where are they?
Wang Jianlin has not had a great year. His wealth has sort of dropped from first place down to fifth place, but he's still right up there with sort of $20 billion or so. Jack Ma from Alibaba has had a very special year. Alibaba's stock has doubled over the last year, yet his wealth has remained static. And that's because he's got a subsidiary affiliate called Ant Financial, where his shares have gone down from 35% to just over 1%, which means that had he kept all those shares, he'd still be number one in China. But instead, we have almost 50 people from Alibaba Group who now made the Hurun China Rich List this year, which is an absolute shattering of the record of number of individuals from any particular organization.
In a country with large state-owned enterprises, Rupert Hugwerf says those on the rich list have become increasingly important to the Chinese economy, accounting for 6% of the country's total tax revenue and employing up to 1.5% of the entire Chinese workforce. The list of 2,130 individuals accounts for no less than a combined $2.6 trillion in wealth. You're listening to VOA Asia. The news never stops, So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. This news alert from VOA Asia. Officials in Pakistan say a roadside bomb killed at least four soldiers and wounded several others near the Afghan border. The troops were part of a search party deployed in the Kurram tribal district to hunt down the handlers of a kidnapped American-Canadian family Pakistani forces rescued last week. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, aid agencies are increasing humanitarian operations to keep pace with the growing needs of the expanding Rohingya refugee population in Bangladesh. The United Nations says a recent surge of new arrivals there has pushed the number of people who have fled violence in neighboring Myanmar since late August to 536,000. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
An influx of around 11,000 Rohingya refugees arrived over the land border in Bangladesh Monday. UN refugee spokesman Andre Mahechich says the border since has been relatively quiet, but he adds that people are still on the move inside Myanmar trying to make the journey to Bangladesh.
Certainly there are substantial numbers being reported of being waiting, trying to get across the Naf River using the boats and then cross into Bangladesh.
A huge aid operation is underway in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, with agencies providing shelter, food, water, sanitation, and other life-saving needs. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies is concerned about the enormous health needs of the population. Red Cross Director of Health Julie Hall says mobile clinics already have helped more than 4,000 people, but that the services available are under significant strain. She says her agency is in the process of deploying a 60-bed referral hospital.
This will be located between the two main camps. It will be able to, when fully operational, provide operating theatre, complex delivery support, as well as outpatients, laboratory, etc. And this will be a facility available not just for the migrant population there, but also the host community as well.
Apart from this, agencies are working to reduce and prevent disease outbreaks. A mass oral cholera vaccination campaign has been underway for several days. The World Health Organization reports 235,000 of a target population of 650,000 people already have been immunized against the deadly disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Experts are warning of North Korea's growing cyber war capabilities in the wake of a massive hack of sensitive South Korean military files. Russia and China may have helped Pyongyang in hacking effort that netted U.S.-South Korean war plans for decapitation of North Korea's leadership. Visit VOA Asia Facebook daily for all the big stories. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a new study that even shocked the researchers shows that most people in poor and middle-income countries suffer unimaginable pain without any help. VOA's Carol Pearson has more on the results of a study on pain management motivated the research group to find a way to help the millions of people who suffer needlessly.
A new study finds that most people in low- and middle-income countries lack even the cheapest painkillers to manage agonizing pain.
We found in this study 61 million people every year who are living and dying in pain and with serious health-related suffering that we know that palliative care and pain relief could solve.
Here, Professor Felicia Knoll visits a cancer ward in Mexico. Knoll's own surgery for breast cancer became the catalyst for her interest in global pain management.
I woke up from a mastectomy and I remember the horror of the pain of not being able to breathe. And yet I got access almost immediately to pain relief, which allowed me to push through it much more easily. When I thought about other women going through this, when I thought about children burn victims, and having their wounds dressed and cleaned and the agony of that without pain relief. And then when I found out how inexpensive it is to solve this problem, a real win-win in global health, that was when we really decided to move forward.
She chaired an international study on pain relief published in The Lancet. The results shocked even the researchers.
We looked across the world using, as a tracer, access to morphine, and more than 100 countries could satisfy less than 30% of need for pain relief just for palliative care alone. And in fact, the vast majority have almost nothing.
In the U.S., morphine costs 3 cents per dose. In low-income countries, it costs 5 times as much if it's available. If costs were the same for all countries, the study says it would cost $145 million to close the gap on pain relief. Even developing countries can work to close the pain gap. Uganda is one example. The government makes and distributes morphine for the country's hospitals. Doctors are trained in administering the drug, and patients are monitored. Noel has enlisted the help of the World Bank to end the pain gap. Plans have yet to be formulated, but the goal is to provide pain relief for the millions of people who truly need it. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
It's called The Bird, and it's a plane from the 1930s. But instead of collecting dust in a museum, it's flying the friendly skies of Maryland near the nation's capital, Washington. VOA's Maxim Moskalkov visited with the bird's owner and learned about its historic past.
This 1930 plane, instead of collecting dust in the museum, still flies over Maryland. However, the most surprising thing is not even that, but the fact that the first American licensed female pilot was learning how to fly on this particular plane.
In the 1930s, this airplane had a special owner. It belonged to Anne Morrow Lindbergh, a famous American writer and one of the first American women to hold a pilot's license. The bird was given to her by her husband, aviation pioneer Charles Lindbergh, the first man to fly solo across the Atlantic. A Washington attorney, Mike Pangea, bought the airplane from Joe Fischera, an engineer who spent most of his life restoring old planes for the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum.
Well, my husband, even though he worked at the Smithsonian for a number of years, and he felt that airplanes were supposed to fly. And it really upset him that he worked on all those airplanes and he never flew. So I could not give it to the Smithsonian because it wouldn't fly again.
I promise to keep this plane flying, even though the Smithsonian wants it. And, you know, maybe someday I'll donate it, but that's a long time off. I will continue flying this airplane.
Joe Fischera bought the bird in 1946 for $600. Today, a similar plane costs around $1,000. And Morrow's Lindbergh's plane is priced at $200,000 because of its historic significance. Fischera spent over 10 years restoring it.
Well, it's very special. It's hard to describe. I've flown many, many airplanes of all types all my life, but flying this one is a privilege. And it connects you to a piece of history.
Pangea met with Anne Morrow Lindbergh in 1993 when the writer was in Washington to receive an award. Meanwhile, the place where the bird is kept is noteworthy in itself. Everyone who lives here is an aviation enthusiast and has their own hangar and airplane, a long way from the 1950s, when this area was nothing but a potato field. Maxim Moskalkov, Sasha Bergen, VOA News, Kent Island, Maryland.
You've been listening to VOA Asia, and we say hello to everyone who's listening in Myanmar via Facebook on VOA Burmese. Thanks for joining us today. We also send our thanks out to director Tracy Carter and engineer Aiden Utku, managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We thank you so much for joining us today. Come back again tomorrow and have a great day ahead.